Kuuntelette Radio Moreenia ja tämä on Totuusradio. Illan lähetyksen nimi on Peltojen poliittinen talous. Minä olen Pieto Hyvärinen ja mun lisäksi täällä studiossa tekniikkaa pyörittää ja musiikeista vastaa Lasse Poser. Tässä lähetyksessä puhutaan ruoantuotannosta ja taloudesta, ruoantuotannon poliittisesta taloudesta, ruokataloudesta, ruokapolitiikasta, taloudesta ja ruoasta yhteen kietoutuvina poliittisina ilmiöinä. Ohjelma koostuu kahdesta luentotallenteesta sekä niiden kommentaareista. Luennot on taltioitu Food Sovereignty-seminaarissa Helsingin yliopistolla 18. lokakuuta. Seminaarin järjesti yliopistojen kehitysyhteistyöverkosto UNIPID yhdessä ympäristöalan tieteiden välisen tohtoriohjelman ja poliittisten, yhteiskunnallisten ja taloudellisten muutosten tohtoriohjelman kanssa. Luennot on englanniksi ja niistä keskustellaan kommentaattoreiden kanssa englanniksi ja suomeksi. Tässä lähetyksessä on kommentointimahdollisuus myös teillä kuulijoilla ohjelman verkkosivuilla osoitteessa totuusradio.fi kautta Peltojen poliittinen talous. Jos nämä kommentit lähettää näiden luentojen aikana, niin mä ehdin ottaa ne huomioon näitä kommentaattoreita haastatellessani. Ja ensimmäisenä luennointivuorossa on Ruby van der Wecken. Hän työskentelee Siemenpuusäätiössä, joka tukee Etelän kansalaisjärjestöjä niiden työssä ympäristön hyväksi. Lisäksi van der Wecken toimii aktiivisesti Oma maa-nimisessä helsinkiläis-tuusulalaisessa kumppanuusmaatalousosuuskunnassa sekä commons.fi-kollektiivissa erityisesti solidaarisuustalouteen liittyvien kysymysten parissa. Van der Wecken käsittelee luennossaan ruokasuvereniteettiä, oikeutta määritellä itsenäisesti ruoan tuotannon, jakelun ja kulutuksen tavat, ottaen huomioon erilaiset paikalliset sosioekologiset ja sosioekonomiset sekä kulttuuriset olosuhteet. Van der Wecken tarkastelee ruokasuvereniteetin esteitä ja mahdollisuuksia niin etelässä kuin pohjoisessakin. Hän puhuu paradigman muutoksesta, jota niin ruoantuotannossa kuin taloudessakin tarvitaan, jotta päästäisiin eteenpäin näistä kestämättömistä menneen maailman malleista, joiden kanssa edelleen monin paikoin eletään ja ruokaa tuotetaan. Tämän luennon diat löytyy ohjelman verkkosivulta, jos niitä haluaa kuunnellessaan vilkuilla. Ja tämän luennon jälkeen otetaan puhelinyhteys Kreikkaan ja mä jututan paikallista kumppanuusmaatalousaktivistia vaihtoehtoisista ruokatalouksista siellä. Mutta nyt siis Ruby van der Wecken, Food Sovereignty Now, So South, So North.
Thank you. It is certainly a pleasure and, of course, an honor to be speaking here today. Thank you, Sophia. I'm also thanking Noel. It's a pity he's not here. That has been a great contact so far. I've got all my hats with me, and it's wonderful there are also different comrades here from all those hats here, so there are not only hats. At the Siemenpuu Foundation, I mainly work at Siemenpuu Foundation, which is carrying out Finnish Development Cooperation, supporting partners around ecological democracy. And actually there I in particularly work with partners in Mali. So wonderful, Mali is present, and India. And then as said, indeed, our food cooperative, Omama, is a very big source of inspiration for what I will be saying, as well as the work doing with the comrades here also around the commons. In a way, Pekka, who of course had to leave, but he has been going, especially in the beginning of his presentation, he went to certain things that also I will be starting off, and as, of course I'll be trying to avoid the repetition, but I would actually want to go to the movement which has been at the basis of food sovereignty concept, being La Via Campesina, for sure familiar to many of you. It was actually founded in 1993 in Belgium when there was a meeting of small-scale producers from different continents. And today, it is arguably the largest social movement. I mean, there are some 200 million small farmer organizations, rural workers, fishing communities, landless and indigenous peoples globally belonging to the movement. And actually also our small food cooperative here in Finland, Omama, which means own land. It's a member of the Southern Finnish Organic Farming Association, SFU, which is actually a member of Via Campesina. So actually also Via Campesina is present here with us. So at that time, in the beginning of the 90s, that was of course when agricultural policies and agribusiness were becoming globalized. So peasants in the south, they were up against all the cheap exports coming from Europe and from the States. So they needed to come to a common vision. They needed to come to a common voice about how they could come to defend what they were about and how they could come to participate directly in the decisions that were affecting their lives. Because until that moment, there was, as Pekka also referred to, the concept of food security. But that meant mainly that how can we get sufficient food through trade or through food aid at different levels. So food sovereignty then as a concept was introduced by the La Via Campesina movement in 1996 at the World Food Summit of the FAO. And then, as also Pekka referred to, it puts exactly producers and consumers at the core of the debate. And it came to then indeed mean, I mean, how can we come to the right to democratically decide how food is produced, distributed, and consumed? Or to actually say it more elaboratively, how can we come to the right of peoples to healthy and culturally appropriate food, produced through ecologically sound and sustainable methods, and to the right to define your own food and agricultural systems? Now, not only movements in the south have been taking to that concept. In the last decade, also people working in the north on their food systems, they've come to realize that, of course, food sovereignty is also an issue for them, as they also have to increasingly face the expansion of agri-industrial model of food production and the increasing corporate control. And so the concept of food sovereignty went global. And then there's a photo of how in 2007 there was a meeting, the first international food sovereignty forum held in Mali in 2007. Nieleni, which was the name of a Malian woman, a peasant woman, who basically symbolizes the hard work, the care, and the innovation with which she fed the people around her. And at the forum, there were more than 500 peasants, fishermen, indigenous peoples, again, youth, commons, consumers, different people from 80 countries. And it was there that 10 years ago, this international movement for food sovereignty set off. So basically, I mean, the contribution of the food sovereignty movement has been, as also again Pekka referred to, not only is it so that small-scale farmers are feeding the majority of the people globally, but they also cool the planet. So here's a slide made by Grain. It's a small NGO which is supporting many of the movements, including also Via Campesina. And there, as already also Pekka was referring to, one of the points being made is indeed that whereas small farmers feed most of the majority of the population, their lands are increasingly shrinking. Basically, they have less than a quarter of the world's agricultural land. And if this tendency is going to be going on, they will not be able to keep up the capacity of the important role that they are speaking today. I mean, there's a kind of reverse agrarian reform going on, so in the south, so also in Europe. Feeding the majority of the population, but also, as said, cooling the planet. I think it will be, for you for sure, are very knowledgeable about the fact that basically an enormous amount of emissions of greenhouse gases are resulting from industrialized food production. So the other points here on this slide that just briefly sharing with you are what are the things to be tackled, or in what ways food sovereignty can be tackling that we can come to a reversal of this picture, because that is what is believed in. Soil, Beck already talked about this. it is believed that we can be, with the right policies, we can be restoring the quality of soil in 50 years if the right policies would be in place. I'm letting some of the other points speak for themselves: the issue of the no chemicals, the issue of going local, the issue of giving back the lands, and then importantly also, and that connects more to how I want to continue, that we should be forgetting the false solutions but focus on what works. And with the false solutions is basically referred to a lot of mechanisms which are only perpetuating the same system as we know it. Things like climate smart agriculture, very close to how the Green Revolution has been failing in its objectives, the GMOs, the carbon markets, the mechanisms at RED, which are basically allowing the main pollutants to continuing their pollution in terms of offset, whereas indigenous people's lands and people's lands are converted into parks and plantations with which the offsetting could be happening. So they work actually all against what is needed, a shift from the globalized industrial food system to having local food systems in people's hands. A picture of Nianeni's last or before last newsletter, in which actually a wonderful activist and writer, Shamal Gutali from Focus on the Global South, she wrote very eloquently how then Nialeni has become a process which is basically has been strengthening the different growing number of conditions that are necessary for food sovereignty. So we're talking about defending and protecting of land, water, territories, but we're also talking about cooperative production. We're talking about resisting of privatization, about dismantling investment regimes. We are talking about defending the rights of communities standing on the forefront, as we were just talking about. So importantly, what she's putting on the forefront, food sovereignty is not only a biological or a technical issue. Very importantly, it is about a paradigm shift. And it's that paradigm shift of food sovereignty, which is, of course, increasingly now under threat. And she refers to capitalism, the entire crisis that we are now living as a situation. Is it climate? Is it finance? Is it economic? Is it energy? All this together is having this assault on this paradigm shift. And tinkering, therefore, with the solutions, it is of very little use. What is needed is systemic change, a complete paradigm shift from competitiveness to solidarity, and from extractivism, an extractivist system, as we have to respect, and from exploitation to dignity. So that is the paradigm of food sovereignty. Now, paradigm shift thinking is also what our farmer Jukka Lassila from Omama, down there on the picture, it's also what he puts up front. And as he puts it up front, he says that for food, of course, it's a core societal thing. Food is first of all what joins us all together, and in whose hands the control of our food system is, including, of course, water. In those hands, the control of our society lies. In other words, people can more govern their own lives if food, the food system, is in their control. And so in that sense, everything that is being done to make food come again back under the control of people is very important for the development of society, for a society to become more just and fair. The above photo is from the farm in Tuzla, where our food cooperative is farming. And we did a survey with our members, what should be written in the field, what should be the message of our field, and came out indeed food sovereignty now. So an aerial picture from there. Shifting more closer to the north, there's a growing push for organics, also in Finland. There have been a lot of food scandals, and I mean, basically, the confidence with regards to our products that we can buy in our supermarket has certainly gone down. And there are today quite some ways in which we can get organic produce. In Finland, according to this study that I'm putting up there, in Finland, the market share of organics in 2016 was reported as being 2% and is rising. Over 80% is then sold through mainstream supermarkets. And besides this, there are, of course, many other solutions. And I think that some of the people speaking after me will be talking about that. The smaller local food shop, the eco groups, different kind of food circles, and we'll be hearing more on that soon. But what I want to be putting to the forefront here, and with that also provoke our discussion, is that basically if we want to come, or that's what is coming the closest in terms of exactly addressing that systemic change that food sovereignty wants to be about, it is the mode of community-supported agriculture. In community-supported agriculture, so basically citizens, they are making a commitment to local farms to share the risks and, of course, also the produce of ecological farmers, and to strive, importantly, of course, also socially, meaning to have just wages for farmers and towards ecologically sustainably produced food. So in that way, farms and families, they form a network of mutual support. This being kind of the way it overall is being organized, there can be many different ways in which a CSA actually operates. Some more pictures of our food cooperative, pictures from Tuusula. So basically the objective of our food cooperative is to come to for our members to be able to give them on a weekly basis food bags in which the needs, the comprehensive needs of one person would be taken care of. So that means that you can have, of course, the produce from the land, but there is also a certain secondary production going on. So the CSA is doing things like oil, like bread. You can see some falafel there, seitan, different kind of products. It's of course it's definitely a substantial commitment in that sense. The idea is to come to building blocks with which we can build much more, starting with food. So to put it in more in numbers, in our food cooperative, when you join, one part costs 200 euros. You can have that for the produce coming off the land. There are also eggs and egg share, which you can get. And then on top of that, there are the monthly payments for the food bags. And they are around 160 euros. It depends on how the price will be set per season. For most people, that is a bag which can be supporting the base of what people are eating in a family. It's a base, and of course on top of that you will still also be getting other things, but the thing is to evolve that. Then again, there are many people which are sharing this bag. Different people come at different weeks to pick up the bag and share it together. A picture of a talkot, the communal lands. We don't have any obligations to do certain work, but this is a point of debate. Should you or should you not make it obligatory that people would come to the lands? And this is, of course, very much connected to the issue of how can we make things sustainable. These are pictures of a greenhouse which was built over the last 2 years, bit by bit, a real do-it-yourself greenhouse with many winks and wonks, but standing it is, and it's beautiful. We have at the moment there are some tomatoes standing there. It still needs to be completely finalized. We've had a fantastic disco at the inauguration in the greenhouse. Excellent sound effects and light effects, and yeah, one of our collective projects. And then also we have a cafe. You're all most welcome to come to Karlantoista. So it's in between Roskapanki and Arla Sauna. You can find Omama's Cafe, which is open during the day between 11 and 3 o'clock. The idea is that the cafe is supporting the cooperative, supporting in terms of showing what we can do with our food. Importantly, it's also a space. For instance, on Wednesdays, there's the Vapalikuvus movement, who will be open as a social cafe for refugees and also giving out legal advice. Our time bank sometimes has meetings in the cafe. So it's fulfilling different kind of space, different kind of functions. Certainly, our cooperative is absolutely not without problems, and I now want to more shift towards that. In fact, we're at a very critical phase, and thumbs up, of course, for it, that we will see our way through. Because it's important also to be provoked in this discussion that how is our involvement with food. On the pictures are actually Farmer Yuka again and both of my sons. My oldest one is 11. You can imagine the thrill it has been for him to be driving a tractor just like that when we were doing our communal works. In that study that I put up front for you about CSAs in Europe, the overview that was made last year, I found a very provocative quote by Trauger Groh from Germany. And he put it for us like that. The terms CSA is actually a bit misleading. It implies that the problem is special support for agriculture. This may seem a good point. However, the primary need is not for the farm to be supported by the community, but rather for the community to support itself through farming. This is an essential of existence, not a matter of convenience. We have no choice about whether to farm or not, as we have a choice about whether to produce TV sets or not. So we have to either farm or to support farms, every one of us, at any cost. We cannot give it up because it's inconvenient or unprofitable. And then he continues to say that more and more people are coming to recognize this and are becoming ready to share the agricultural responsibilities with the active farmers. And then he also goes on to say, what I also put there, the quote, that the CSA is not just another clever approach to marketing, but community farming is about the necessary renewal of agriculture through its healthy linkage with the human community that depends upon farms and farmers for survival. And that's, of course, those links that I also hope to strengthen when you go with your children to the farm. As the study also puts up front, and I think that it's extremely important when we talk about how can we actually realize this potential? How can we come to this kind of supported community support, supported agriculture? How can we really realize this? It's a rethinking of economy by, with, and for citizens. And that is also what the paradigm shift of food sovereignty is about. And this paradigm shift thinking, which now want to connect to our whole discussion, is actually ways to call it would be the strengthening of solidarity economy building, and through this, a furthering of our commons, in this case, our food commons, and the commoning around it. Allow me to explain. Solidarity economy is a movement of other economy thinking originating also from the South, which actually helps us to address economy from a food sovereignty CSA perspective. First of all, it puts on the table that economy, it's not that of the experts. It's nothing else but a discussion about what is the way that we organize our daily lives, and it should be a discussion of the people and for the people. Secondly, it then puts to the forefront that unlike mainstream economy wants us to think, if we look around us, if we put the right lenses on, we can see all kind of different layers of activities that are actually having very other values up front than monetary profit making, namely the values of solidarity, which in this case wants to mean a commitment to diversity, to the fulfilling of autonomy, equality, radical democracy and ecology. And that actually solidarity economy building, that building of another economy, which is having other values up front, we could imagine that in a given locality, we could be mapping these different economic activities, making them visible, but importantly also making it possible for them to find each other more, to link up, and to in that practice come to new, in that process come to new practices, which can be strengthening each of these actors, and we could imagine the coming to another economy. Very quickly, although as said, probably very confusing to put such a big thing up right now, wanting to show you perhaps something to see later for anybody of you interested, a very typical map that is being showed when talked about solidarity economy building by an scholar and activist, Ethan Miller. It's showing you the different spaces of economy in which you could be making visible, mapping out, charting the different kind of examples of economy that are putting other values than profit up front. And how you could then come to imagine that it's through their cooperation that we can be strengthening other economy. So then I put a circle in which you have our food cooperative, Omama. You also have up there another food cooperative, Hertoniemi Ruoka Osuuskunta, which was the first CSA in Finland. You also have in there a particular community currency, a complementary currency of Helsinki Time Bank. It could also be another local currency. And you have a civil society organization there that is having links towards Africa. So you could imagine that through this working together of these different actors, these actors could be strengthened. Financing in this picture is extremely important. And now I put here Helsinki Time Bank, but you could think of local currencies. You could think of the issue of basic income. How could it come to be so that actually really food and food production could come to play such an important part in our lives? Obviously, discussions as basic income, as complementary currencies, are very much related to this. To come to the completion of the paradigm shift thinking, what we're having here is that food stops being a commodity. Food becomes a commons, something which beyond market or even state, something that is being co-cared for, cared in terms of responsibility, in terms of reproduction by the community of users. And this being the paradigm shift that food sovereignty wants to talk about. And this is something we can all engage with. This is also something that we could come to demand more policies for, as we also, for instance, in Helsinki would want to be doing by wanting to address with the city. Can we come to a forum for the commons? Can we come to a working group for the commons? Where exactly issues like this, how can our food become more of a commons, are to be addressed. When Pekka was talking about like what do people in the South say when, what is it that you want? A comrade of our group, Niklas Toivakainen, once had a very interesting interviews in India, and he asked the Indian peasants there, as you know, very real structural problems going on, and farmers that are committing suicide in great numbers. He asked them, so what is it that you want? And they said it very clearly, grow your own food. So this, now I stop. The point that I wanted to be making, that food sovereignty is about a paradigm shift. It's something very provoking. It's something, a challenge for each and for one of us. And I also leave with the question then for the speakers that are coming also after me. When we address what kind of forms we take ourselves part in that struggles, what are those forms that are really supporting that structural change? And how can we make it so that those experiences are strengthened instead of perhaps experiences which, in a way, provokingly, I'm sorry, are more to be seen as reformist tinkering with things like consumerism. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
on siis Totuusradio ja lähetyksen nimi on Peltojen poliittinen talous. Äsken kuultiin Ruby van der Weckenin luento Food Sovereignty Now, So South, So North. Ja nyt lähetystä jatketaan Kreikasta tulevan puheenvuoron parissa. Jenny Kiuki on kreikkalaisen vaihtoehtoisen ruokatalouden toimijoita yhteen tuovan Agroecopolis-verkoston perustaja sekä eurooppalaisen kumppanuusmaatalousverkosto Urgencyn ohjauskomitean ja tutkimusryhmän jäsen. Ja Jenny, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me well?
Yes, we can hear you. Welcome to the broadcast, and thank you for finding the time to participate. I understood that you are having quite hectic times there with the newly founded NGO Agroecopolis. Can you tell us a little more about the NGO?
Okay, so Agroecopolis is the Hellenic Network for Agroecology, Food Sovereignty and Access to Land. And it's actually the product of many years of collaboration with people of the movement of food sovereignty in Greece. We felt last year, well, in February when we were founded, we decided to take this step because it was necessary, it was the right time for a grassroots NGO that deals with things that are relevant to food sovereignty to be created. So we took it upon ourselves to do it, and we haven't been proven wrong yet for that move that we made. Mm. We are the focal point for food sovereignty in Greece and also for community-supported agriculture. And it's very unfortunate that in the last few years, at least in European media, they've stopped talking about the situation in Greece as if everything is normalized now, everything is fine. Mm. That's obviously not the truth. Things are not getting better at all. And we feel that this is a very important part of what we have to do outside of Greece, to let people know of what exactly is the situation in the country. And it's very unfortunate that I have to bear this bad news because... Mm. This is the time when selling out everything that still belonged to the country, this is the big sale now that is beginning. So we have things from land grabbing, which is starting, to debt grabbing, as I call it, because as we're talking about agricultural land, most of the Greek farmers that... owe a lot of money to the state because taxation in the years of the crisis has gone way up. So has direct taxation and indirect taxation, as well as contributions. And especially if I'm talking about the agricultural side of things, imagine that in 2012 we gave away the, I don't say sell, as you noticed, I say we gave away the Agricultural Bank of Greece. And as an agricultural bank, you can understand that most of the Greek farmers had mortgages and loans with that bank. And all of these now have been rolled on to a private bank. And obviously, when this bank starts asking for its money back, we're going to have an issue. We have a big issue because people in Greece owe a lot of money to the state because of being unable to pay all the tax and the contributions. So this is already a very big issue when it comes to access to land for people that want to start farming again.
Yeah, well, that's...
So I already started telling you some of the issues that we're facing in Greece.
Yeah, that sounds serious. So how do you, in this organization, then tackle these issues?
Well, it's not, I mean, there's a very long way ahead of us. Mm. One part of this way has to do with awareness, raising awareness within the country and within the European Union, and doing advocacy work towards that. So we are just starting a research project together with FIAN and the Transnational Institute in order to look at the impact of all these austerity measures to the right to food in Greece, because that is also a very important thing. During the years of the crisis, the accessibility to food, and I'm not even talking about good food, I'm talking about accessibility to food, full stop, that has gone down for a big percentage of my fellow Greeks. And it is very important that we finally bring this out to the open, because I think even from the beginning of the crisis, when it was being reported that there's children who are fainting in schools, this wasn't received well within the country, and it wasn't received well in the European Union as well. And I think one of the reasons was that we never wanted to touch on the subject that something like that can be happening within the modern and civilized European Union. But this is actually the truth. And as testimony to that, I can, for example, tell you that in Greece we've never had school meals. I mean, never. That wasn't ever something that was in the school program. And in the last few years, this has been introduced exactly because of the problem that there are children in whose families they don't actually have enough to eat on a daily basis. So schools had to start doing something about that. So in some cases we've got now school meals taking place. In some others we've got the headmaster sending notes to all the students' parents, asking them in a discreet way to let them know if they're having trouble feeding their children, so that perhaps, you know, the school can take it upon them to do something. And as you, I mean, if I hadn't told you which country I'm talking about, I don't think anybody would have guessed that I'm talking about a European member state. So the fact that this is happening in our, well, it's not in our back door, it's in our front yard, but we just decide not to look at it. And if the idea is that, well, Greek people brought it upon them, I'm sorry, but I don't agree with that. Because at the end of the day, the situations that have brought us here have to do with the lack of democracy. And as you're talking to a Greek, and we're talking about the word democracy, democracy means that it is the people who are in charge. And I think that it's very clear for at least all of us in the European Union that it is definitely not us, the people, who are in charge, not just in my country or in yours, but in the whole European Union as a whole. Because at the end of the day, the people of the European Union, the people in Brussels, most of them that end up making important decisions that affect the livelihoods of the people of the Union, they're not even elected. So they're not even answerable to us. And this is a major issue that we don't seem to be talking enough about within the European Union. And of course, democracy and having democratic structures in place is one of the pillars of food sovereignty. Because this is, I mean, we're talking about the people gaining the power, the people becoming sovereign over the food chain, let's say, you know, over everything that has to do with how food is produced, distributed and consumed. And of course, without democracy, you can't change anything. We need to change the tables. So that's a huge amount of work, I think, for all of us in the food sovereignty movement in all countries. What we try to do in Greece, because, I mean, it's sometimes it feels like trying to fight the waves, you know? Every time you try to tackle something, and then there's another wave coming from another side. Because this is what happens in a country in crisis. It's that new fronts are being opened every day. And this is what actually brings you in crisis, the fact that you can't deal with five different fires at the same time. But and of course, to that, I can add the situation with the refugees, which is another thing that it feels to the Greek people that they've been left on their own when it comes to their European partners. So what we are trying to do in Greece as Agroecopolis is, first of all, to try and deal with practical things like having enough food to eat and making sure that our farmers can be sustainable. So one of the first things we do is that we promote and we help CSA groups, community-supported agriculture groups, to be created and established. It's one step to self-sustainability. It's a way to create smaller communities of people, to bring people together, to give them a certain hope about what they can achieve. Because at the same time, imagine that you live in a country where everything, every day, I mean, every day there is a piece of news that can make you feel worse. Every day there's a piece of legislation that means that you have to pay more, or you have less rights. So every day there is something to make you sad, let's say. And it's very important to make people understand that this is not the end, that not everything is lost, that coming together and fighting for the commons, fighting to preserve even respect for ourselves and for the future generations and for the environment, that it's not a lost cause and it is worth fighting. So by making sure, for example, that consumers and producers come together in a way that is direct, without any intermediaries, and making sure that they are both made more sustainable from creating this connection, is a step forward. So that's one of the things that we are doing, for example.
Yeah.
As I said, I mean, when I talk about the environment, we now have the big water companies, Suez and Veolia. They're trying to take over the water companies of the big cities, and they're trying to infiltrate other areas as well. We've got mining companies from Canada getting contracts to do over the ground mining, not with galleries underground, but over the ground mining, because the quantity of gold, I mean, I'm thinking of a specific case of a gold mine that has been around since the times of Alexander the Great. So, I mean, the Greeks have been mining there since, you know, thousands and thousands. And by now, and of course, in those years, they were doing it in a very sustainable way. Now, the amount of gold is less than 1 gram per 1 ton of soil. And obviously, to them, it doesn't make any sense to do mining under the ground. So they are now opting to do it over the ground with explosions, you know, controlled explosions, like some tens of them on a daily basis. The result of that is obviously, I mean, to the environment, to the people around, to the livelihoods of farmers and beekeepers, to the ancient forest that has been, destroyed in just a very quick decision. These are all horrible results, but the whole point is that because you're talking about a country in crisis where it does not work in the normal way anymore, this company has been allowed to get this mining license, and the Greek state is not going to benefit from that, not even 1 cent. So it's not only that we are destroying what's there, But things are done in such a way that the Greek state doesn't even gain anything. So what we are doing is we are destroying the future for the future generations, but also we are destroying the environment. Greece is a country that about 30% of it is under Natura protection, Natura 2000. This is all about to change. The privatization in Greece does not only have to do with the ports and the airports and the telephone companies and all that. It also has to do with the environment. And the environment is one of the biggest treasures of Greece. Greece has one of the highest biodiversities in Europe. And this stands to be destroyed so that, you know, some banks and some people are going to make more money in their pockets. And I think this is a very sad thing that we have to stand by and watch.
Yeah. Well, at least it was very true that the media coverage does not actually cover any of these issues that you just described.
I can tell you one more thing that is,
go ahead.
I mean, in the last few months, it's becoming very present. And this is this has to do with wind turbines, because you see, we always have to be vigilant and we always have to look at the greater picture. I mean, we know that wind turbines are a good thing, and we know that it falls under the regenerative sources for electricity. Well, yes, but everything depends, because what is happening recently in Greece is there's some German and Austrian old wind turbine technology, which obviously is obsolete by now, as they've got better machines that can work more efficiently. And so they've hatched up a plan so that all this old technology is going to be dumped in Greece, and not just anywhere in Greece. They're choosing very beautiful sites in the middle of, you know, like virgin forest lands, in islands, in natura places, in places where people go to enjoy a walk, where there's a lot of flora and fauna. So they are creating these huge wind turbines made of concrete, which are only going to have a life expectancy of something like 10 years. The way that they store energy is such that, and because in Greece, if you produce electricity, you have to sell it to the grid. So through this way, about 95% of the electricity created by these turbines is going to be lost. And the environmental destruction we're going to cause is huge. The same goes for tourism as well. And, I mean, we can't help but wonder, why are we doing all these things? Why is it still the private gain of some specific people is always put, you know, in front of the good for the people, for the country, for the environment? And, you know, these are big fights that you can't fight very easily. And imagine that things like that happen in Greece now every other day. A new thing, a new scandal, a new, you know, pressing decision has to be fought. And we are just not enough to fight everything. Mm. And just to give you an idea of these privatizations, until now, the majority of Greek airports belong to a private German company. The ports have gone to Chinese companies. Our railroads is bought by the Italian state Ferrovia, the railroad company. And, I mean, as I said in the beginning, this big sale, this big bazaar is just now starting. You know, there's lots of places that are on sale. There's beaches that are about to be privatized. I'm just very sorry that the next generations of kids, they're not going to grow up in a country like the one I grew up in. I mean, this connection with nature, this freedom to go anywhere, it's just not going to be there. It's all going to be gone.
Yeah.
Privatized.
But I think that the work that you are doing around food sovereignty is really important in this context, because it connects so many struggles with the land and with the actual food, so that people can.
That's true, and obviously this is what keeps us going.
Yeah.
But it's a hard fight. We do not necessarily have the government on our side, because even the government is bound, that they can't do anything they like. And at the same time, I don't want to talk about what I think the government is there to do. What I know is that on our side, and one of the reasons why we created Agroecopolis is if you want to create a legal entity in Greece, like a non-profit, an NGO, for example, it costs about 1,000 euro, the cost to set it up, the lawyers, the accountants, the fees and everything. And then you have a yearly tax of 1,000 euro per entity. So it's not an easy thing. Even if people want to, come together in a group and do things formally, it's very costly. So one of the reasons why we created Agroecopolis was to help to be like a hub for groups of people, for collective initiatives that work on issues that have to do with food sovereignty, to provide a way for them so that they can have access to some sort of resources. Imagine that the banking system in Greece, still since 2015, we are still under capital controls. It's not very easy to do things in Greece still, and this is again something that people are not even aware of outside of our borders. And one of the biggest problems that we are facing is exactly that, the lack of access to funds, to resources, for ways to be able to do things here. It's a very difficult situation, but at the same time, as you said, it is the right time to keep going and
do
not stop. We are also trying to find ways to become more self-sustainable, because as I said, being an NGO, from the moment you start, it means that you have expenses, unlike in any other country in the world, where being a non-profit company means that at least you don't have to pay a yearly tax. Well, as I said, that's not the case. So one of the things that we started, for example, this will be the second year that we do that, is solidarity exports specifically for citrus fruits, so like oranges and mandarins and lemons and olive oil. So things that only grow here, but there is a demand for them in North Europe. And we are helping some groups of small agroecological farmers. We are trying to do this export to things like CSA groups or collective buying groups in the north of Europe. We only want to do it with citrus fruit and olive oil, because we do not want to come in any sort of competition with local farmers in those countries. Mm. And we only want to do that in solidarity groups, as I said, from one, let's say, CSA to another CSA, from a CSA in Greece to a CSA in Germany, because we want to find a way to help these farmers and help them get a good price, help the consumers get a good price, and then the producers give a small percentage to Agroecopolis, which means that we can then fund some action to do something. And I know that we live in very different realities right now, me and you, mm-hmm. but imagine that we've come to the point where even, people want to attend a meeting and they don't have the money to pay the 50 euro to pay for the train ticket to go from one city to another.
Yeah.
So even that is a great help. You know, we don't need millions all the time to help people, but we are in a situation where even a very small amount can be very important for people. Yeah. And we need to find ways to help them out. Because right now they live in a country where it seems like everybody has forgotten about them. And if you think that that's not true, I remember in July when there was again talk about, you know, the next dose of this, you know, the constant bailout schemes, which, by the way, I mean, any decent economist, if they look at the situation, if they look at how the debt was created, how it was dumped on the backs of the Greek people, and how it's actually, you know, being serviced, anyone can tell you that this is not a situation that can end well. Because at every turning point, it's like we are given an option. You know, of course they tell you that there's always an option. And what you have to do is you have to bring water from the well to the house. And I give you a bucket that has holes on the bottom. So always the option that we seem to be facing is that either I give you an extra hole in your bucket or I give you an extra 10 meters to walk. So this is not working out. This is just an impossible situation. And we need to face that because people here are not doing well. And because we are privatizing everything, we are throwing away the sovereignty. We are throwing away anything to do with the commons. In July, when we were talking about this next dose that we had to take, as if we are, you know, as if the country is a junkie, you know, waiting for the next fix, we heard the Prime Minister say that, well, the Troika has said that we will talk about cutting the Greek debt in 2060, 60. So in July, we were told that we are going to talk about doing something about the situation that this debt is creating in 2060. We're going to talk about it. So the situation in Greece, unfortunately, is not going away, and it's not getting better. And people need to understand that. And it's not because you want to do something to show solidarity for the Greek people, who at the end of the day might be on the other side of Europe, and why should anybody care? Well, I think that we need to do something because we need to showcase how the European Union is operating, how the Common Agricultural Policy is operating. And I go back again to the issue that we started with, the lack of democracy. Because if right now this lack of democracy is affecting the people of Greece, well, it could be that in another scenario it's going to affect the people of another country of Europe. And I don't think we need to wait until everybody has become a victim of this, until we finally start thinking that we need to do something to change things, that we need to institute some sort of accountability for what is happening.
Yeah, I totally agree. And now I must thank you for this really thought-provoking talk and wish you courage and good luck with all these issues that you are facing there. And I also hope that you will find the collaborators from Northern Europe. I guess that also maybe in Finland there could be some CSAs or other collectives that could be interested in citruses and olive oil.
Well, we obviously would welcome any kind of help.
Yeah.
And just to say that if anybody wants to contact us, our website unfortunately is not ready yet because, as I said, we are grassroots people. We don't have money. We are just a few of us trying to do everything at the same time. But we don't have a website ready yet. But if anybody wants to come in contact with us, you can write us an email. And the email address is bethechange@agroecopolis.org.
So bethechange@agroecopolis.org.
Thank you very much for hosting us
and having
our voice heard.
Yeah, thank you very much for your talk, and I wish you all the good.
Thank you,
Jenny.
Well, next year in November probably in Thessaloniki, where I'm speaking to you from, we are hosting the the fourth European community-supported agriculture meeting. And at the same time, it will be, because it coincides, it will be the seventh international symposium on community-supported agriculture.
Okay.
So you are welcome to come next year and see for yourself.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too. Siinä siis keskusteltiin Jenny Kiukin kanssa, joka on kreikkalainen kumppanuusmaatalousaktiivi Thessalonikista siis. Ja nyt Totuusradion peltojen poliittinen talouslähetys jatkuu siis toisella luennolla, joka on niin ikään taltioitu ruokasuvereniteettiä käsitelleessä seminaarissa Helsingin yliopistolla lokakuussa. Äsken kuulun Ruby van der Weckenin luennon lisäksi luennoimassa oli siis ympäristöhistorioitsija, maantieteilijä ja Binghamtonin yliopiston sosiologian apulaisprofessori Jason W. Moore. Hän on tullut tunnetuksi muun muassa teoksesta Capitalism in the Web of Life, joka luotaa talouskriisien, ympäristökriisien ja ruokakriisien kytköksiä ja tarkastelee kapitalismia ei vain talousjärjestyksinä, vaan maailman ekologiana eli luontoa järjestävänä ilmiönä. Ja tässä seuraavaksi kuultavassa luennossa Moore keskittyy ruoantuotannon järjestymiseen kapitalististen suhteiden kehittymisen myötä 1700-luvulta nykypäivään. Ja sitten tämän luennon jälkeen täältä studiosta vielä soitellaan tämän Mooren ajattelua hyvin tuntevalle tutkija Tero Toivaselle Helsinkiin. Ja muistuttaisin tässä vaiheessa, että ohjelmassa on edelleen kommentointimahdollisuus lähetyksen sivuilla totuusradio.fi/peltojen poliittinen talous. Mutta nyt siis Jason W. Moore, The Crucible of Cheap Food, Capital, Class and Climate in the Unmaking of Modern Agriculture.